Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. Most people would agree soap is necessary for good hygiene, but for some people, soaps and the chemicals and fragrances that are often found in them can cause a strong allergic reaction. This is what our guest learned years ago when he worked as a window washer. When Larry Pleasant founded his company in 1992, his goal was to make products that won't harm consumers or the environment. Larry joins us now to talk about Vermont Soap Company, based in Middlebury. Larry, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thanks for having me on.
Yes.
Terrific.
Oh, great.
Great thing to be doing on a rainy morning.
Of course. Yes, it is. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Larry a question, or if you're a Vermont soap user, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So, Larry, let's begin by learning about the company today. What is it that you produce?
Okay, well, Vermont Soap, our main product is natural stuff that foams. The majority of what we make is certified organic. Everything we make contains organic materials. And for us, what that means, organic means audited natural. And in this, you know, this crazy world we live in, people make all kinds of claims, and they don't mean much. The word natural is bandied around. It really has no meaning. And my favorite stories is a guy comes in, he says, hey, you make natural stuff here. I said, yeah. He says, oh, great. He says, I have natural almond fragrance. I said, buddy, there's no such thing as natural almond fragrance. And he says, yeah, it's the fragrance of almonds which are natural. I said, sorry, man, no sale.
Wow, that's bending it a bit. So you started this back in 1992. How has the company grown, you know, to today? How many employees do you have?
Oh, my. Oh, my. Okay, 1992, it was a sweet lady from Central Vermont, Liz, if you're listening, hello. She was my first employee. She walked in wearing Birkenstock sandals, and I said, I don't think you're allowed to wear those. This is, we're starting a manufacturing operation. I mean, literally, we had no idea what we were doing and started from there. Liz was going to work one day a week, helping me get some shipping out. And she says, well, I guess I'll see you next week. I said, the heck with that. I'll see you tomorrow. And
wow.
She worked 21 and a half years for me.
Oh, my gosh.
We've been in business going on 29 years now.
Oh, that's so great. How many employees today?
Right about 35.
Oh, that's great.
We have a few openings if you're looking for a career in part-time career in natural products there, Rick.
Oh, okay. I love wonderful organic soaps with great fragrances. So, yeah, maybe I'll come by. And are all the products made right here in Vermont?
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Everything we sell, we have a soap dish that's made about half a mile away, right in Middlebury, that we've been marketing for years, a wooden soap dish. And I'm trying to think, is there anything we resell? Not that I can think of right now.
Wow.
We like making things. We're manufacturing. and if it's nice, we want to make tens and tens and tens and tens and hundreds of thousands of them.
Yeah. I kind of alluded to 1992 and you being a window washer, but what was it? How did you get started in the soap business? I don't think this is something you set out to do.
Oh, when I was 4 years old, I thought I wanted to be James Bond, I think, or something like that. But or maybe a little older. But
so after you gave up the secret agent business.
Yeah. What was that?
I said after you gave up the secret agent career that you had.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted a career in science, and I've always loved science and science nerd. I've always wanted to know what makes this universe work. And I vowed that before I'm dead, I'm going to figure it the heck out. And, of course, it's so multi-layered, it'll take more than a lifetime, I'm sure. But I wanted to make a career in science. And I had a series of individual, seemingly random occurrences over time in my life, all of which seemed to shove me into the natural stuff business. That's a fact.
So you're saying,
let's hear some of them. Okay.
That's what I want to hear.
I knew you did. Okay, first story.
You're going to make me fish.
16 years old, walked into the Randolph Co-op, one of the few co-ops in the country. That was 1976. Mm. And
I took dance lessons right above that, the Randolph Co-op. Yeah, tap dance lessons.
How did that serve you? Well, you're still in show business, right?
Yeah.
It got you in a certain direction.
That's right.
Good for you. At least you can dance. So few white men are good at that. I appreciate that. You can dance. I can't dance. So I walked in, and the manager there, and I could see his face as clear as day, and he comes up to me. And I'm very shy. I'm 16. You know, I don't talk to people much. And he goes, "So, what?" It sounded very rehearsed. He said, "So what position are you going to take in the new alternative economy?" And I looked at him, and I said, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Look around. This is the new alternative economy, and you're part of it. You're buying stuff." And he says, "You know, are you going to make your living in this? Are you going to own a store? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? Are you going to grow good food for everyone? What are you going to do?" And I said, "I like to make things. I like to make batches of things, big batches of things." He goes, "Oh, a batch man. That's good. That's good." We started talking about mayonnaise. We started talking about miso and soy sauce. And I remember he pointed to this bottle of soap by this was called Dr. Something's. I won't say the name, it's trademark, but a very popular hippie soap. And he says, "Well, one thing we don't need is we don't need soap. We've got this stuff. We've got the good doctor." And I said, "Oh, you know, I used to really like that stuff, but I get a rash from it now. My skin's too sensitive. I can't use it." And he goes, he like pretends he's talking in a microphone, and he goes, "Oh, which soap will be the milders, the doctor's or this kid's?" I thought it was funny. Anyway, so it stayed in my head a little bit, but that wasn't enough to do it. And years later, I was on Center Street in Rutland washing the windows at Murphy's Bar and Grill. And a gentleman comes out, and he looked like he had a 3-martini lunch. And he's a little bit tipsy, I could tell. And he comes out, and he looks at me washing the windows, and he says, "Good job, $20 an hour from one end of town to the other." And this was now 1985, I guess, six. And I looked at him, and I started, you know, I was feeling playful. So I said, "Hey, buddy, I don't get out of bed for less than 25 an hour." And he goes, "Oh, okay, you got some spunk there, you know, right. got some moxie." He goes, "Okay." He goes, "Kid, I like you. I'm going to give you 3 minutes of my time." Okay.
Yeah.
And I said, "Okay." And I was feeling playful. I said, "But I have to make a dollar first." He goes, "Click on this." He goes, "Clock's ticking. You got 3 minutes." So I had this trick. I washed the window in 9.5 seconds, so, you know, more or less. And he looks at it and he goes, "Not bad, you know." And I said, "No, it was 17 seconds. And I said, "The world's record's 9, so I'm not even a contender. But thanks. You know, I've been practicing this one. Speed window cleaning, very obscure sport." So he says, "Kid," he says, "when you die, they're going to bury you with that squeegee right in your hand, right on your chest." And he said, "Everyone's going to be there, even the mayor." He says, "You're going to be the biggest funeral this town is." "What town is this?" He says, "Oh, it's Rutland." "Okay, right. Yeah, this town has ever seen." He says, "And do you know why that squeegee's going to be on your chest?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Because no one will be capable of frying it out of your cold, dead, arthritic hands as you work yourself to death." He says, "You're going to go, you're going to buy a house, you're going to pay it off painfully." He says, "Then you're going to borrow money again to put your kids through college because they're not going to take over. They're not going to do what you did for a living." Hmm. I said, "Wow." He says, "Hey, this is the real world, kid." He says, "You need product to go with your service. And I said, well, I learned to put window film on, you know, like they put on cars. He goes, how's that going? He goes, I said, I live in Vermont. It's not going very well. He goes, exactly. You need a product. And he started going through it. He said, there are products you buy, just things you buy just a couple of times a year, like a couple of times in your life, like a house, right? There are things you buy, you used to buy every 5 years, maybe more often now, like a car. There are things you used to buy every 12 to 15 years. Now they don't last as long, a washing machine.
Right.
And he goes, I go, but what's the best commodity to be in? And he goes, well, the best is under $5. And again, this was in the 80s, so now I say $10. But so I would say now, under $10, you use it up, you buy another one. There's something special about it, so you tell your friends. There's something proprietary and tricky about it, so they don't just take your manufacturing overseas and come back and, to use his words, slit your throat and leave you bleeding in the gutter.
You learned some lessons,
man. You are hardcore, buddy. I really appreciate that. And at which point, I looked at him and I said, very thoughtfully, I said, and it has to be completely natural and it has to fit Vermont. And he looks at me, he goes, boy, you are tough. At which point I jumped up, grabbed his shoulders, started shaking him and yelling, what is it? What is it? And he shrugged his shoulders, shrugged me right off, very casually, very calm. And he goes, well, that's up to you to figure out. He looks at me and he walks to the middle of Center Street in Rutland, you know, kind of a semi-quiet street. And he stands there in the middle and he turns around and he goes, see you on the cover of Inc. magazine, kid.
Oh, my goodness. Now, Larry, you started making Castile soap. What is that?
Okay, sure. Let's start right at the beginning.
Okay.
My first product was a bar soap for sensitive skin. Mm-hmm. And I developed a quick method of making soap in a microwave, believe it or not. And I made hundreds of experiments and came up with a formula after 6 months for the base formula. That's, you know, what the stuff's actually made of. And then we add botanicals to that. So oatmeal, lavender, different oats. So I would buy every kind of oat I could find. I test everyone. Most of them, you know, were like sandpaper.
Right.
Found one that worked right. Found a little trick to make it softer. But, you know, we'd work every detail bit by bit. It would take me time. I would develop. And I went on for 10 years. The first 10 years, I just did bar soap. And then I got kind of bored with it. And I started making liquid soap, which is known to most people as Castile liquid soap. And so the question becomes, what does Castile soap mean? And for that, we have to go back in history. Soap came from Syria. It's an African product. Came across northern Africa with the original Arab, the first Arab Spring, which was, when was that, in the 900s, I believe, AD. And of course, the so-called Moors invaded Spain and brought soap making to Europe, if they did not have it before then. And so Castile refers to La Castilla, the area of La Mancha, in Spain. Basically in central Spain. Now, it was a soap that was made from coconut oil, and it was used for cleaning. It was used for laundry primarily, and was a very strong, kind of rip your skin off. Pure coconut oil soap is almost impossible to use. Oh. And the original soap was made from olive oil, which is extraordinarily mild, but difficult to make in large batches. There was seasonally, there's an olive oil shortage. Every so many years, the olive crop just doesn't really produce. So they started using coconut oil. Pure coconut oil will rip your skin off. They started blending it. Eventually, the word Castile soap came to mean a soap that is at least 5% olive oil. And that's the basic European definition. In the United States, we don't have a formal definition, so it's a marketing word. And so it basically means any kind of soap with olive oil in it, of any amount. So it has very, very little meaning. To most Americans, Castile soap means a liquid soap made from coconut oil and olive oil and other oils, other vegetable oils. And that's what we do. We use a secret amount of olive oil, right about 5%.
Oh, boy. And that softens the skin. I love using any kind of product that has olive oil in it. When I have rough and cracked hands, that olive oil is just fabulous at helping it. So you mentioned botanicals. Is that the kind of the scent, what you use for scents? You create the fragrance without being irritants?
That's our goal. Of course, even herbs are powerful plants, and they have their chemical factories, as all plants are, and fungi. And so, first of all, we use natural essential oil. They were originally made from basically a souped-up espresso machine, if you will, a steam distillation system. And now a lot of it's CO2, which gets a more complete extraction and has just a very slightly different product. So there's a real renaissance, I'm saying it right, of essential oils and interest in it over the past 30 years. So we use natural essential oils in different blends. So, a lot of this is kind of typed up as, people say, oh, this oil is good for this, this oil is good for this. I divide it a little differently, and I'll give you a very quick story. I used to make one flavor, and I make a lot of it. So one day, I had three basic bar soaps. So one day I made peppermint bar soap, and then we made it for like 3 days straight. Mm-hmm. So every day the factory was filled with this peppermint.
Right.
And everybody was running around like they had 10 cups of coffee. I never saw anything like it. I said, who changed the coffee? What is going on around here? And then, that was over, and we did lavender. And people were walking around like they didn't get enough sleep, like they just woke up, kind of slow and dreamy. I said, holy moly, it looks like there really is something to that. And then after a few days, we did orange, and it was just right. And I later learned that there was a study in an office building in Japan where they pumped a little bit of orange oil through the air handlers, and efficiency increased about 15%.
And if they wanted it to go through the roof, they would pump in the peppermint.
Oh, don't do it. Everybody, it's all smoke, no fire. You just make a lot of mistakes.
I got
everybody's
you.
All busy, but nothing's getting done. Talking really fast. And it was really interesting. And I began blending from all three food groups, if you will. From all three. I put a little bit of everything in it. And developed a signature style. People tell me when they walk into a store, they have very good noses. Even if our display is in the back of a small store, they can walk in, take a smell, and go, oh, you carry Vermont soap.
Wow.
And the distinctive way we blend them is kind of, yeah.
Well, what kind of response did you get and do you get from people who have had similar reactions to soap that you had, and then when they finally find your product?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Of course, we've been around nearly 30 years, so often the reaction is, oh, I have your stuff in my bathroom right now, which is incredibly embarrassing to me. I'm not in it to be a movie star, obviously. A friend of mine has a daughter who's famous in Brazil, and I heard her almost hit single from down there, and I said, you're so talented. I had no idea that you could pass for a Brazilian, for one thing, and a Vermonter, and she looks at me, and I could see that her moments of fame really troubled her. Mm. Like not everybody wants to be famous. Not everybody really wants that kind of attention. And she says, well, I really admire the way you make soap. And I said, touche. Okay, we're even.
There we go.
I won't bother you again.
How can people – where are your products sold, Larry?
Sure. Originally, health food stores, that was our original outlet in the quote-unquote new alternative economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now the majority of our work now is well, let me just back up a little bit.
Yeah,
okay?
Sure.
Okay, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Because we're trying to span nearly 30 years of hard work and
we've got 2 minutes left.
Wow. Okay.
I know.
So So Vermont Soap makes yummy stuff to replace all the yucky stuff for all the good little girls and boys. Second.
That was a little too terse.
That's how I explained it to my five-year-old. Okay. So we built the factory, and we sell under our brand. And for many, many, many other companies, we support the industry. So we'll make liquid soaps and gel soaps, which we invented, and we will, and the world's first certified organic pet shampoo and many others. So we'll take these products and we will make them or a version of them for other companies. And in that way, we're supporting the conversion from using artificial fragrances, artificial colors, and petrochemical foaming bases to using literally organic farming method producing raw materials and turning them into products which are healthy for you and certainly healthier.
All right, we're going to go very quickly, very, very quickly to Nola in Ripton. Nola, go.
Go. All I have to say is thank you, thank you, thank you. We love your soap. We go down to the store twice a year. We're not big shoppers, but we go down, we fill up the bags, and it's so great. There's no packaging. There's no take off the wrapper, take off the wrapper. It's just good, amazing soap, and it doesn't smell all perfumey and
yeah.
The soaps you buy from the store. It's great soap, and I'm so glad you're there. Keep the good job up.
All right. Thanks, Nola.
God bless you, Nola.
And Nola mentioned the store. You have an outlet in Middlebury, correct?
We do. We have a little factory outlet. We sell, we like to say, we sell Dents and Benson Second. Everything in the store is discounted when you walk in. You're saving 15 to 20% on any product right away. And then we sell Dents and Benson and what we call naked soap by the pound. We actually weigh it out and on a street legal scale with a sticker on it, and you can just put it in your own bag and go. We also have a refill station for liquid soap products.
Oh, brilliant!
That we put in. We did this years ago.
Larry, right? We got a roll. We could go on forever. I love this guy, Larry Pleasant, founder CEO of Vermont Soap Company in Middlebury, and you can learn more, listeners, at vermontsoap.com. Larry, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. He is a rock star in soap. We're going to take a break for a news update, and then we're going to come back and look at Vermont Farmers Markets here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I do this every year at this time. I start checking farmers market websites to see when the first ones of the season are. There are several reasons that I love farmers markets. I have vendors who I've gotten to know through the years, who I love catching up with. I eat better food and much more produce when the markets are in session, and that includes the winter. And I love handing over my cash to a local farmer, cheesemaker, brewer, baker, craftsperson, or Momo maker. Directly, no middle person. And I love finding new people to buy from. Well, we are on the cusp of market season, and I am getting pumped again. So let's meet a couple people in charge of a few of these farmers markets. Daniel Stroll manages the Bennington Farmers Market. Daniel, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Yep, you're welcome. And Carrie Ryan manages Capital City Farmers Market in Montpelier. Carrie, great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you've got a question for Carrie or Daniel, or if you want to share your thoughts about farmers markets, you can give us a call at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, having a little problem with my headphones here. Carrie, I mentioned why I love to go to farmers markets. What are other reasons you hear people tell you about why they patronize, or reasons you think people should patronize farmers markets?
Yeah, I loved what you said, actually. Every single thing that you pointed out made me smile.
Good.
That's exactly what I think about when I'm at the market myself. And this year, it was really, because it was my first year with the market, so maybe I'm not as experienced, but it felt like family, you know? And especially in this last year where we've been so distanced, and not being from Vermont myself, so I don't have family here, it really feels like a second family. And the market, the Montpelier market, has been around since 1977. So a lot of these vendors have been there, or some of them have been there since the beginning. But many of them have been there for many, many years. And we spend every Saturday together. And not only the vendors, but our customers. I get to stand at the entrance and greet the same faces every week. And I can't see their smile, but I know they're smiling.
That's right. So they're masked
it was
right
kind of
now.
One thing. Yeah, but it kept me sane this year for sure.
Yeah. Daniel, what's your favorite part of working at the farmer's market?
Well, you know, I just came on to the Bennington Farmer's Market back in August, so I'm still kind of getting my feet wet with it all. But, you know, I totally agree with everything that everybody said so far. You know, it does feel like family. You know, I've made, you know, just in this short time, I've made so many good friends, either with vendors or customers. I also appreciate that, you know, farmers markets are, you know, kind of a staple of a community. They're kind of how a community is judged. And, you know, I've lived in Bennington for several years, and, you know, I've always attended the farmers market, and I've always, you know, kind of seen, you know, I've always, you know, compared it as a customer to other farmers markets. And, you know, now's my chance to actually, you know, put Bennington's best foot forward, if you will.
Yeah. Now, I have been to probably at least a half dozen around the state, but alas, Daniel, I have yet to visit the Bennington Farmers Market. So you got to help me here. You know, where is it? When is it held? And when are you going to get started this year?
Sure. So we're getting started actually tomorrow. Tomorrow is the first day of our summer season.
Congratulations.
We did have a winter season. Yeah, well, thank you. We did have a winter season this past winter, but it was all online due to COVID. But normally we do it every other week during the wintertime. This year we are actually moving our summer location to a new location. It's a lot more visible. It's a lot larger space because we definitely like to start expanding the market. It's by the Deer Park, right on Route 7 North. So we'll get a lot of traffic there, and, you know, hopefully it'll become, you know, like I said, you know, more of a staple in the community with that increased visibility.
Outstanding. Carrie, the winter market for you in Montpelier was pretty interesting. What happened after you had Thanksgiving and Christmas markets on the State House lawn?
Well, we had such a great turnout that we decided in true Vermont fashion, we were just going to would go ahead and do an outdoor market. So we were outdoors in the winter every second and fourth Saturday throughout the season. So we had some really, really, really cold mornings. But I couldn't believe it. Some of our vendors said they had the best sales they've had of any winter market ever. So the community was really, really supportive.
Yeah, I don't know how it was for vendors to have to stay there for hours, but as a patron, and I was to yours year two, and then I was at Burlington, had one outdoors, and we're Vermonters, right? In the winter, we go outside, we play, and to get fresh vegetables and the things we want from our farmers market vendors, no big deal.
Right. Put on an extra coat.
Yeah, that's right. Put on an extra coat. Make sure you got the darn tough socks on. And, yeah, and just buy. It was fantastic. Now, Carrie, where and when is your summer market, and when's it getting going?
Yeah, so we start tomorrow as well. Very, very excited.
Nice.
We are in our new permanent home, which is 133 State Street, which is the tax department parking lot just west of the Capitol building. We are 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. every Saturday through October.
All right. And Danielle, tell us about the vendor mix that you have at the Bennington Market.
Sure. Well, we obviously have veggie vendors. We have a couple meat vendors, all selling locally produced vegetables and meat. We have a few craft vendors, and we're getting a lot more interest from crafters this year. We got quite a bit of interest from crafters at the end of last year, too, just because, you know, the typical craft markets out there still haven't really started up yet, so they're still looking for a place to sell. We also have a few bakers. Some of our bakers have just the most delicious treats. And if I had to set up next to them, I'd be 50 pounds heavier, for sure.
I love it. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're also seeing a lot more interest from CBD and hemp vendors.
Yeah.
With a relaxation of rules regarding those products here in the state.
Yeah, I see. You know, I like that you push those baked goods and really sold them so that I make the trip down to Bennington for one of the markets. I need to do that. Now, Daniel, what kind of COVID protocols did you put in place last year, and what do you have planned for this summer's markets?
Sure. Well, we're constantly in touch with the Vermont Farmers Market Association to determine, you know, what's in the state's guidelines we can do and what we can't do. We started off last summer without music, with one-way traffic, obviously with masks and physical distancing. We spaced out the vendors quite a bit just to, you know, make sure all bases were covered. The UVM extension, they provided a hand wash station for us. They've since provided a second hand wash station. And like I said earlier, this past winter, we at first wanted to go inside, but we just, you know, found out quickly that, you know, we couldn't have that many people in even a larger space. So we went to online only, and that ended up working out really well for all of our customers. You know, they could still sell. All our vendors could still sell and keep going throughout the winter. This year, pretty much the same as last year. We will have music. We won't need to do one-way traffic, but we'll still do physical distancing. We'll still require everyone to wear a mask, and we'll still have the hand wash stations out for everybody to use.
And Carrie Ryan, any additional protocols that you want to mention that you've incorporated at the Capital City Farmers Market in Montpelier?
Very similar. You know, we will maintain a controlled entry and exit, and masks will still be required, and we will offer hand sanitizer at the entrance and at the picnic table area. But thankfully, things are kind of calming down a little bit. So yeah, we're very excited to be bringing back music as well. So we'll have live music every Saturday and hopefully some events. So you might see the corn roast. You might see the strawberry festival. You might see the fall festival. So, yeah, we're still going to be very safe. And obviously, it's the safest place to shop. But we are looking forward to a more typical market season.
And what type of vendors do you have at your market, Carrie?
Oh, my gosh, the best.
Those are fighting words, Daniel.
Sorry, Daniel.
There's no overlap. We're all right.
Local meat, local cheese, organic meat, baked goods, jams, jellies, quiches, eggs. I mean, everything you can possibly think of. We do have quite a few craft vendors this year as well. A lot of new faces, a lot of farms we haven't had in the past. But, of course, all the old staples that everybody knows and loves, LePage Farm, Pete's Greens, Red Hen Baking Company, Peg's Pantry. So, yeah, all of your favorites plus a lot of new faces.
And I'm not sure if it's too late or you still, you know, have vendors join you during the year. But, Carrie, how does someone become a vendor with your farmer's market?
Sure. Yeah, we accept applications throughout the year. They can find our application and our Capital City Farmers Market rules and requirements on our website, which is just capitalcityfarmersmarket.com. And they can review the rules and the requirements and fill out an online application there, and then it will be reviewed at the next board meeting, which right now we're doing about every 2 weeks.
And Daniel, I know some of the farmers markets will have, I think they call them day vendors, but might be someone who can't necessarily be there every week, but can fill in when there are openings. Do you do things like that in Bennington?
Well, we don't require our vendors to come to every single market. We do offer a discount on stall fees if they do come to every market of the season. So about a third to a half of our vendors are seasonal vendors, and the rest are market by market. You know, typically they'll come to pretty much every market, but you know, they may, you know, miss out, you know, for a kid's ball game or something like that here and there. So, you know, we allow them to kind of set their own schedule, and it kind of works out for everybody.
And do you have requirements, Daniel, for your vendors on what they're allowed to sell and their presence, their retail presence there at the farmers market?
We do have rules and regulations. We are a producer only market, so we don't allow anybody to come in with, you know, reselling, you know, commercial items. And we don't allow anybody to come in, you know, who's baking something that they're not necessarily making from scratch. You know, if they're just baking from kits, we don't really want to see that. You know, for the most part, you know, we're pretty flexible when it comes to what people want to offer at the market. And, you know, the more variety, the better.
How about you, Carrie, in Montpelier?
Very similar. We do have some fairly strict rules about owner attendance. Owner of the company must attend at least 50% of the markets, and local ingredient rules as well, and also a producer market, so that everything has to be coming from Washington County or the surrounding county. So yeah, we're fairly selective, I suppose I could say.
Yeah. And, Carrie, are there any changes for this summer's market that people will notice?
Well, I think music is probably the number one thing that everybody's really missed. We are allowing dogs again, which we didn't for quite a bit last year, and everybody loves the dogs coming back. But it's going to be nice, and we'll see what happens in July when the mask mandate changes. We will probably still keep requiring masks, but you know, we may get to relax that at some point, which would be nice to see people's faces again.
Yeah. Daniel, you mentioned music would be back this year. I even noted on your website there were pictures of some belly dancers who have performed at your market. I don't think you were in that picture, but what?
People want to see that.
Yeah. You have a new location. Anything else for people to look forward to in Bennington this year?
Well, one advantage of this new location is that we'll have lots more space, not just for vendors, but for other activities and for local nonprofits and community groups to set up a tent, set up a booth. We're already kind of filling out that schedule right now. The Southern Vermont Natural History Museum is actually planning a raptor exhibit one weekend. We'll have kids' activities through the Bennington Museum. You know, a lot more fun stuff coming from our local nonprofits. So that's one thing that we're really, really excited to be able to offer, in addition to, you know, just adding more vendors and creating more opportunities for local entrepreneurs.
Daniel, let's pull back the curtain a little. What kind of staff do you have for the farmers market?
Me. we have a board of directors.
Yep.
And we have occasional volunteers, but as the manager, I'm the only paid staff, and so it kind of keeps me busy doing that along with my my day job.
I could almost answer that question myself when I heard your laugh when I asked that question. Carrie, is it the same at Capital City, or do you have a little bit more of a staff there?
It is the same, me, myself, and I. I so appreciate you mentioning that, though, because we are always in desperate need of volunteers. So if anybody's in Montpelier and would like to spend part of their Saturday with us, we would love to have you.
Excellent. All right. And I'm sure Daniel and Bennington with open arms would take volunteers. What happens, Carrie, in the case of inclement weather on a Saturday when you're going to have a farmer's market?
Well, as you know, having been out there this winter, it would take some pretty severe for us to shut down. So we are open, rain, snow, shine, doesn't matter. It would have to be a pretty bad blizzard that would be, you know, unsafe traveling conditions that would shut us down.
I have to admit, if I wake up on a Saturday morning and it's a crappy, crappy morning, and if it's the winter, if it's of a farmer's market, it's probably 50% greater chance that I will go that day because I know how badly those farmers need me on that particular day. Right?
It's absolutely.
And I bet you there's a lot of people who have that same feeling. It's like, I got to get there. I have to go give them cash on this day. Right? So, hey, Daniel, in Bennington, is the city, or I guess it's a town, involved at all in the market business with you?
So the town has been a great support for us, and the town owned the park where we previously were located. The park where we're moving to now is actually owned by the Vermont Veterans Home. Oh. And they've been a wonderful partner so far, and you know they've been very happy to have us there and to see some more activity on the lawn of the Vermont Veterans Home. But yeah, we work closely with the town, with the town's economic developer, with the local chamber of commerce, which is actually located right next to where our market will be, in trying to make sure that, you know, we're meeting the needs of the town and that we can partner with the town in whatever ways make sense.
And Carrie, I mentioned NOFA a few minutes ago. How involved is NOFA in supporting farmers markets here in Vermont?
Oh, incredibly supportive. I'm actually lucky that I got to join the board this year, and that's been an amazing experience to just have all of their support. We have board meetings about once a month, I suppose, and they also support the Crop Cash program, which is really important for our EBT users. And they were able to triple it this last year for us. So every $10 that they used or that they took from their EBT, they got an extra $20 in Crop Cash, which was amazing. So it was a huge help to people during this last year.
Carrie Ryan manages the Capital City Farmers Market in Montpelier. Daniel Stroll manages the Bennington Farmers Market. And to learn more about farmers markets near you, you can go to nofavt.org. Carrie and Daniel, thank you so much for being on. It was great having you.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care. We're going to break now for CBS News, then we'll be back to talk with national correspondent Bob Ney. And Sox fans, tune in this evening. Sox at 7:05 for pregame, 8:05 first pitch. Sox against the Texas Rangers in Texas. It's game two of a four-game series. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th. Time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren Store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's time to turn to national correspondent Bob Ney to get caught up on the pandemic, the president's speech, and more. Bob Ney, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
And, Bob, let's start off with the COVID numbers.
Right. Total deaths worldwide are 3,156,000, and the total deaths in America are approximately 575,000. Now, the good news is that the infections fell about 16% over the past week in the United States, so that's, you know, a big improvement. And more than half of American adults have gotten at least one of their doses of the vaccine, and that seems to be helping, obviously, in the outbreak. The U.S. averaged about 55,000 new cases per day over the past week, and that's down from 66,000, 10,000 some down a day. So, is it, you know, really, really good news? No, but is it good news? Yes.
Better news, yeah.
Seems, yes, it's the beginning somewhere.
And one place that hasn't had better news since you and I spoke last week is India, where I guess it's gotten more severe, the situation there.
oh, it's just reeling out of control. We're not even sure of the statistics because it could be anywhere from 2 to 5 times the amount what they're telling. Now they're calling on the Prime Minister Modi to give an accurate account. We are sending $100 million worth of supplies to India that was authorized by President Biden, and their deaths are reaching a worldwide high. The country, according to what they're reporting now, Rick, their death toll surpassed 200,000, but again, it could be anywhere 300,000, 500,000. It could be 1 million. We just simply don't know. I have talked to people actually this morning in India that I know, and it's fairly bad there. Now, they did suspend, as of tomorrow, the age requirement. So they're just saying any age, come get a shot in India.
Wow. Do they have enough vaccines, Bob?
No. They have 1.2 billion people. And so they're going to have to really work to get this done. I was talking to another friend of mine over there, and she was telling me, you know, it probably is not going to make a dent until they really get into maybe next year on this, if they keep up with it. Just with 1.2 billion population, this is going to have to be a kind of worldwide effort to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move next to President Biden's address to Congress earlier this week. What are the takeaways that you had from it?
Well, on one hand, I mean, the president, and I've sat through the State of the Unions. I do know President Biden. I served in Congress. He will tend to talk a lot, mm-hmm. and I'm not trying to be a harsh criticism. No. It's just his nature. We all know that.
Right.
He kind of added everything under the sun into the speech, so there was a lot of material to work with. But he started out in front-loading the speech with what I think is important, which was his view of the COVID, the economic agenda, and where we're going to go. Then he touched on a whole wide variety of other issues, you know, including police and race and climate and, you know, different issues like that. But he really kind of front-loaded it with, you know, basically what I would call his economic agenda and his family, American family plan.
Right, which includes things like child care, free community college. It seems like he's really tilting progressive with that American family's plan.
Well, he is, and I think part of the problem with this, and I will be critical of Republicans too, by the way, so on the nation's budget. Republicans have kind of lost that fiscal, idea they used to run on. That's kind of by the wayside over the last 10 or 12 years. But with President Biden's plan, one good thing, whether people agree or not, he's providing how you pay for it. I think the downside to some of the family plan is that these are programs that will go on for a long, long time. And we went originally, Rick, from we have to deal with the pandemic, we have to have unemployment, we have to have some money, you know, if you have children, a stimulus plan. We went from that to get through the pandemic to funding things kind of forever, you know, if you want to look at it that way.
Right.
And there's a proposal of $109 billion, 2 years for community colleges, if there are 2-year programs to make that free, enhancing the Pell Grants, paid family and medical leave, which workers receive, I think, $4,000 a month through the National Leave Program, with 2/3 of their wages would be, you know, subsidized through that leave. And then there's some things like their nutrition for, you know, for children. And then he'll expand the child tax credit through, I think it's 2025, and then beef up the Affordable Care Act. So it's a lot of things geared to families, but it's also sort of permanentizing, for the most part, I think you would, it is the thought of the per child $300 per month, benefit from the government.
Now, when we stack up, Biden's COVID relief, infrastructure plan, families plan, American families plan, I think we're talking somewhere in the vicinity of $4 to $5 trillion total. I might be wrong on that, but that's a lot that we have to think about how we pay for.
Well, yes, and, you know, for example, in 1998, we had the first balanced budget in generations. You can tell that was a campaign theme of mine, how I spitted that out. I want to be candid.
Touché,
but
Bob.
We did, with Bill Clinton and the Congress, we did that. The whole talk about the balancing nation's budget is not even discussed at this point in time. So we used to kind of shriek at $400 or $500 billion. Now it's in the trillions.
Right.
And at some point in time, I think that they will have to be careful, because this could, you know, cause hyperinflation. And so, you know, I think this has went from pandemic assistance to a program that's more permanent, or more, I guess you call it, a progressive side.
Yeah. So there's a difference between stimulating an economy that has been, you know, racked
Correct.
By the pandemic to all of a sudden, yeah, piling on.
Creating it, yeah, you what you
it.
Want.
You got it. All right. So next, let's talk about Afghanistan, the U.S. pulling out there. You had some reaction from both Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton on that.
Isn't it interesting to see both of them on, basically,
yeah.
for the most part, on the same side of this? I guess you could label Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice, and of course, Condi Rice was with George Bush, as more on the hawkish side, and they're basically concerned or putting out a little bit of warning about too fast of a troop withdrawal by President Biden. Of course, President Trump, you know, started the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. We've been there, you know, for a long, long time.
20 years.
The longest war, right, in American history. So it was interesting to watch the two secretaries of state. I don't think it has any impact whatsoever on the president pulling the troops out.
Yeah. And let's talk about Attorney General Merrick Garland, and what are we seeing so far from him?
Now, this is going to be very interesting to see. Because Merrick Garland was getting a little bit of heat because they were saying, well, you're not going after, you know, Trump people, et cetera. And Merrick Garland, if you look at his history, he's kind of a soft-spoken type of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's trying to, you know, take over the Justice Department's Attorney General and make it run in a different direction. But obviously he kind of broke that you're not going after the Trump, quote, people by going after Rudy Giuliani. So that that kind of kept the progressive side a little bit quiet, and he is going after you know, Rudy Giuliani. But on the other hand, there's more to it than just that. There's the course of how the department's going to be run. He has revoked Merrick Garland the sanctuary cities that were basically by the last Justice Department were basically, you know, sanctioned. He's reversed that so sanctuary cities can function without a lot of pressure out there. And then also there's a pattern of practice he's looking at police departments following the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. He's looking at patterns of practice in police departments. How far he'll go with that, I don't know. That's a whole another show we could talk about how the Justice Department historically does that. And he also has a 30-day expedited review of how justice can better prosecute and track hate crimes. And then, again, besides how he's going to have the department run and, quote, depoliticize it, he also has to carry out the executive actions of the president on gun control and how he does that across the nation. So he's going to have a big challenge. And, of course, he's got the special counsel, John Durham, and they're going to have a report at some point in time, I don't know when, of alleged abuses by Obama. How does he handle that, and how does he handle any aftermath of Hunter Biden? Those are the two other kind of side political things.
And talk about side political. I mean, the Giuliani thing, not the easiest thing to follow. So what exactly is going on there?
Well, this is, from a personal point of view, you know, as someone who's had the Justice Department say we want information, we mm-hmm. turned over through subpoenas, you know, 258,000 some emails, right, through the system we had.
Mm-hmm.
We were not raided. I wanted to stress that, because as I sit here, I look at somebody who is raided, and you have to say, why don't they raid and why do they raid?
Yes.
You know, we weren't raided in our offices. And I think with Giuliani, it was a matter where the Justice Department was not going to let him decide what was pertinent to the Ukraine issue. So I think that's why they went into his home and his office. Now, Giuliani is going to argue attorney-client privilege. We all hear that in our lives every day,
right.
You know, on TV. And he's going to argue that with President Trump. But here's the problem. Look at short history. Cohen was the president's lawyer. He argued all of that with the Justice Department that, you know, I have attorney-client privilege, and they narrowed it and said, you have it on these couple of specific items, but you don't on all the rest. And I predict to you they'll do that with Giuliani eventually. He can't just claim everything they took was attorney-client privilege. So I think it's a, you know, it's a turning the temperature up on him by the Justice Department, no question about it.
National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, great having you on and clearing things up that's going on nationally and internationally. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you, Rick.
You've got your spouse and the kids working and attending school virtually, running computers, charging laptops and phones, watching TV, and you think your electric bill is high. Please excuse the folks at Global Foundries in Essex Junction for not feeling sorry for you. They've got some serious utility bills, and they have a plan to get out from under them. Here to explain all that is 7 Days political reporter Kevin McCallum. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. I will very much do my best to try to explain this, but it's a tricky one.
It is a tricky one, and it will bite it off in small bites and see what happens. How big an energy user is Global Foundries?
So when reporting this story about Global Foundries wanting to basically break up and leave Green Mountain Power, the largest utility in the state, I was amazed to learn just how much power Global Foundries uses. They use more power than the entire city of Burlington. I mean, they are a semiconductor manufacturer on the shores of the Winooski River, as your listeners probably know, but I had no idea that they use that much energy. They crank out chips for the telecommunications market, and they do it in high volume, and that place runs 24/7, 365, and they have an automated system in many cases that just uses a phenomenal amount of energy.
And that power use, what does it represent in relation to the whole state?
So actually, if you looked at the state of Vermont as a whole, just that one factory, just that one fabrication plant, as they call it, uses 8% of the entire electricity usage in the state of Vermont. So that gives you some sense of the scale of what we're talking about here.
How big is the workforce there now at Global Foundries?
So this is obviously, as you probably know, the former IBM semiconductor manufacturing facility. And it used to have, I think, as many as 8,000 people working there. But these days, they're closer to 2,200 people. And it's now owned by this company that's now based in New York called Global Foundries. And they're very high-paying jobs. They're excellent jobs. The state of Vermont is happy to have Global Foundries here and to keep this facility up and running and operating. But it is smaller than it once was.
Now, you called it a divorce from Green Mountain Power. What exactly are they proposing to do?
So, as anyone who pays a power bill every month can sympathize with, paying $36 million a year to Green Mountain Power stings a little bit. They pay far lower electricity rates at their fabrication plants in New York, and they would really like to find a way to get their power costs down. And they've talked to Green Mountain Power, and they've signed special power contracts with Green Mountain Power that give them a low rate, but they would really like a lower rate. And the only way at this juncture that they can see that they can lower their rates even further is by separating themselves from Green Mountain Power so that Green Mountain Power is no longer their power utility, right? They would like to set themselves up as their own power utility, serving themselves only. And then by doing so, they think they can go and sign some direct power contracts with a power provider or a series of power providers where they can, cut out the middleman, essentially.
Wow. And then how, without Green Mountain Power bringing it, how do they get power delivered to the plant?
So one of the reasons that Global Foundries thinks that it can do this and argues that it can do this is because they have a direct tie-in to the grid. If you look at that facility from the air, they have massive electricity power lines, transmission lines strung over the Winooski River coming to their facility. So you and I couldn't just slap up a couple of solar panels on our house and say, you know, we don't need our electric utility because that's just not how it works. But these guys are different. These guys are tied in directly to the grid, and they could sign a contract with a power provider anywhere, really, and have that electricity delivered through the grid directly to their campus.
Is this unprecedented, or is this something that other large companies do from time to time?
It is absolutely unprecedented in Vermont. I'm not sure about other parts of the nation. I think for large factories in other parts of the country, I think there probably are some examples of this. But in Vermont, it would be the first time that this would be done. And that's a little bit concerning to lawmakers. Some of them brought up the concern that, well, okay, if we allow you to do this, where does it end? You know, what about UVM Medical Center? Could they just say, yeah, we're going to start our own utility or another manufacturer? And so that's what there's some concern about.
So first of all, is it legal? And if so, what's the process for them to get approval to do it?
I'm going to skip the legality question because okay. I think that's open, right? Oh. I mean, the process is going through the PUC, the Public Utility Commission, and I think there might be some people who are going to try to argue that it's not legal. I definitely heard some testimony in the Senate a couple weeks ago that suggested it is legal, but it's novel, right? It's like the first time that someone has tried to argue that they can set themselves up as their own utility. And I believe it requires a bit of legal interpretation to argue that they have that right. But they have asked regulators to allow them to do it, and there's going to be a long process by which they determine whether it is allowed or not. Hmm.
Do you have an idea of how much they figure to save if they can cut out GMP?
That was a tricky one. They are not exactly forthcoming with how much money they think they can save, but they did drop a couple of breadcrumbs in their lengthy PUC filing. They do note that by buying power through Green Mountain Power, they are paying, and everyone is paying, a higher rate than they might otherwise to support clean energy projects, to support renewable energy projects in the state, which do cost a little more, right? And most Vermonters are happy to pay those higher rates to support. But that was on the order of 6%. And so if they could get out from under that and then maybe get out from under some other fees, I think there's some thinking that maybe they could save millions of dollars.
Yeah. Now, how will the loss of a major customer for GMP affect the rest of its ratepayers?
Excellent question. That's kind of the big one, right? That's what everybody cares about. How is this going to affect my bill, if at all? And that one was a bit of a surprise, too, because Green Mountain Power's spokespeople argued that there really is only going to be a nominal, a limited effect on rates of less than 0.5%. Over the four-year transition period, by the end of the four-year transition period after GlobalFoundries leaves. And that's largely, they say, because GlobalFoundries is willing to pay the piper, as it will, to get out from under GMP, and they're going to be paying something on the order of $16 million, $16.3 million to offset the impacts to ratepayers. Because think about GMP, this is their largest customer. This is $36 million out of their pocket. And so you would think that there would be a big hit to the utility to lose this big customer. But they say, look, you know, they're paying us a big chunk of money to leave, and we won't have to pay about $30 million to buy the power in the first place. So it's not actually as bad as you might think.
Hmm. Will GlobalFoundries be held to those renewable energy goals that the utilities are now that they are a power company?
Well, that's actually going to be the sticking point, because that is one of the main concerns about allowing such a large energy user to go solo effectively. Like, wait a minute. So wait, now you're not going to pay the higher power costs that subsidize essentially the renewable energy in the state of Vermont. How cool is that? How appropriate is that? And so they will not have to pay the higher rates that subsidize renewable energy in the state of Vermont. But what they say in response to that is that they will nevertheless be putting together a power portfolio that will be very green, that will be from renewable sources, so don't worry. And people who are concerned about that say, well, you know, we'd rather not have to take your word for that.
I'm looking at this with the most positive viewpoint I can. You know, there's a four-year period they're going to be paying. Does this indicate that Global Foundries is making a commitment to Vermont, at least for, you know, the near future?
I think that this proposal could be viewed as a sign that they really want to stay in Vermont and thrive here, yes. I think what they're saying is, look, power costs are high in Vermont. We love it here, but it costs a lot of money to do business, and we need to be competitive. We need to be competitive with New York. We need to be competitive with our other chip manufacturing facilities in Singapore and Germany. And if we don't figure out a way to get out from under these high power costs, we're not going to be competitive anymore. And the company is not going to invest its latest, greatest chip technology here in Vermont. It's going to invest it somewhere else. And then what will it be? In a few years, we'll be obsolete, and then we'll just have bigger problems and bigger headaches. So I think it is their – I think they are making a commitment to the state in the sense that they would like to stay here, and they're saying this is what they would need to stay here.
Mm-hmm. Kevin McCallum is a political reporter for 7 Days. You can read his story in this week's issue at 7daysvt.com. It is fascinating. Kevin, thanks so much for – you did a great job of explaining it, and I think for us to understand even the parts where, you know, we don't know yet as it starts to unfold. So thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
All right, you too. We're going to break for CBS News, and then we're going to return to talk about COVID vaccines and vaccinations. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Mother's Day is May 9th, time to celebrate that special woman in your life. Treat her with a card or gift from the almost world-famous Warren store. Our Rockin' Deli will be offering a special grab-and-go meal, or you can wine and dine her at the Pitcher Inn, our sister property across the street. They are offering a special Mother's Day brunch and dinner. Check out our websites, warrenstore.com and pitcherinn.com. Make it a day trip to quaint and beautiful Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Open daily, 7:30 to 5.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. People are rolling up their sleeves while other people are rolling on by the opportunity to get a COVID vaccine. Some are skipping with delight after getting dose number two, while others are skipping dose numero dos. What's going on? And what should you know about the fits and starts of some of the vaccines like J&J and AstraZeneca? I never pretend to know the answers, but I like that there's someone nearby who does. Lindsay Leiniger is a clinical professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School, and she is the nerdy girl in chief at Dear Pandemic. Lindsay, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be here again.
I can't believe nerdy girl in chief just didn't roll off my tongue. I apologize for that. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Lindsay a question about COVID or the vaccines, we're at 244-1777. 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. Email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. It's been many months since you were on last, so please explain again what Dear Pandemic is.
Sure. So Dear Pandemic is a education platform that provides timely, trustworthy, and credible information about the pandemic. We're on Facebook, and we also have a website, dearpandemic.org. And I'm really excited to tell you, Rick, that we hit our 1,000 post mark this week.
Wow.
We have posted 1,000 evidence-based posts about the pandemic.
That is incredible. When did it actually get up and going? When did you start?
We started in March of 2020, March 14th, and we have been going strong ever since. We write faithfully twice a day, every day.
And why are you part of this, Lindsay?
Well, my background is helping policymakers make sense of medical data. My PhD is in health policy, and I am also a teacher of making sense of medical data to MBA students at Tuck at Dartmouth. So I decided to start helping my friends and families make sense of all the medical and public health data that we've been awash in since the beginning of the pandemic. And it just got started, and I teamed up with some friends and colleagues, and here we are. Here we are a year later and 1,000 posts.
Amazing. When we spoke last, it was December 17th, and vaccines were just beginning to be rolled out. So how did the initial rollout go?
Well, it was a tough start, but it really got its sea legs quite quickly, is how I will characterize it. And what's pretty amazing to me is that we are now at a point where almost 100 million Americans are fully vaccinated, which I think is just a milestone that we should be celebrating. It's just been incredible what's been accomplished in such a short amount of time.
Wow, that is incredible. Yeah, and when you think about a year ago, we weren't even sure if we'd have vaccines rolled out at this point, or maybe they would just be getting rolled out, you know, a year into the pandemic. So, you know, a year plus, and we have 100 million fully vaccinated in the U.S. How did we kind of get more efficient? What happened to kind of make sure the rollout got better?
Well, the vaccination campaign has had some helpful tailwinds in the form of money and federal support, and both of those things matter. So across the country, we've been able to stand up vaccination clinics everywhere from your local pharmacy to the former JCPenney in West Lebanon, New Hampshire, and everywhere in between. So I think just a bunch of boots on the ground has been a key piece of this. Also, we have had the kind of amazing energy of the vaccine companies, the producers of the vaccine, who have really ramped up their manufacturing and efficiently and effectively pushed out hundreds of millions of doses. I'm not an operations person, but it sure seems like a huge feat to me.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you mentioned the former JCPenney's. We have one right here in Berlin, Vermont. That's where I got my shots. They still had the big jewelry displays, but unfortunately I wasn't able to buy any jewelry when I was there. Now, we hear, you know, about, you know, going to waste, unused, spoiled doses. Have we seen a lot of that? Has that been a major problem with the rollout?
Happily, it hasn't. So that is a very gut-wrenching headline.
Right.
And so I feel like the few cases where this has happened have gotten perhaps more airtime than we'd want to give them. But I want to be reassuring that that has been exceedingly rare.
All right, good. That's good to hear. I do like when I hear that someone's been contacted, you know, at the end of a day, and they were able to hop in line, you know, and get a dose that might have gotten spoiled. I love that, you know, that was happening, even if it meant someone got, you know, cut in line a month ahead of me. I don't care. You know, this was the right thing to do. Let's get it in somebody's arm. Let's address
with you, Rick. Shots
right?
in arms.
Shots in
Shots
arms.
Shots in arms.
All right. Let's address some of the hesitancy, because it's there, and I can understand that everyone does not think like me, you know, or you, shots in arms. What are the main reasons people are avoiding the shots altogether?
Well, happily, there's a lot of confidence and a lot of people who are enthusiastic about receiving the vaccine. So I like to focus on that. And I have had hundreds upon hundreds of conversations about vaccines now with people in Vermont and New Hampshire. And I think I'm heartened by the fact that hesitancy is not born out of any sort of ill will or anti-vaccination sentiment even. It's just people wanting to take the time to get the good, credible health information and make a good choice for themselves. So I do feel like it's come from a good place primarily. And frankly, it's on me as a scientist and as a teacher to help get people the right information to feel good about making the right choice.
Now, some people, there are reports of a lot of people getting one dose, not getting the second. This isn't on the J&J. This would be on the Pfizer or the Moderna. So, you know, how well is somebody covered if they do that? They go for dose one but skip dose two.
So happily, the last I checked, 92% of people are getting that second dose. So I'm going to flip the frame.
All right.
As a longtime healthcare researcher being like, darn, that's pretty good. right? Because life gets in the way and we're all busy. So we're doing pretty well on getting people in for their second dose. That said, there are some access barriers and there are some people who are unable to get there on schedule. But the good news is that first dose does provide protection, meaningful protection in the interim between the first and the second dose. So by all means, go get that second dose, but it's okay if people miss it by a week or two. You are still enjoying some protection.
All right. We have a caller on the line who called yesterday, Allison, and Allison definitely was able to give her opinion yesterday. And, Allison, I just ask that you be respectful and get right to your question as quickly as possible for our guest, Lindsay Leininger. So go ahead, Allison.
Oh, are you talking to me, Allison? Because this is a different Allison than yesterday.
Oh, okay. All right, Allison. Go right ahead then.
Okay, so good morning, and thank you for providing the platform for conversation. I really appreciate it. I just wanted to get to the question. So I have been definitely deeply concerned about experimental injections and a massive biological experiment that's been going on with around the world, really, and also very deeply concerned about infringement on constitutional rights, which obviously elected officials are, you know, in place and elected and take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And so obviously many of these civil liberties have been infringed upon because of this pandemic the past year plus. So my question, when I dive into this and I do the research, I have a master's in science in human nutrition. I've been involved in preventative public health for over 20 years. And where I go back to really is the heart of the problem, in my opinion, is the PCR test. And so the PCR test is, one, not a gold standard test. Despite what people are being told, PCR tests, by definition, are a surrogate test. They have emergency use authorization only. When you look specifically on the 80-page CDC diagnostic panel instructions for this test, I quote, this is on page 40 under limitations.
Allison, I'm going to ask you to get to the question.
I will, but I have to preface it, if you don't mind.
Please.
Yep, so limitations. Detection of viral RNA may not indicate the presence of infectious virus, or that 2019 novel COVID is the causative agent for clinical symptoms. This test cannot rule out diseases caused by other bacterial or viral pathogens, period. So if we have a test that's not specific for COVID and is not a gold standard test, and this is what drives the cases, which drives the fear, which drives the state of emergency and the infringement on constitutional rights, we have set ourselves up in a vicious cycle. And we had an example of this. You're from Dartmouth. I don't know how long you've been at Dartmouth, Lindsay. In 2007, the New York Times had
Allison,
an article entitled...
your question, please. Yep. Please, to your
yes.
question.
This is my question. In 2007, in New York Times, they had an article entitled Faith in Quick Test Leads to Epidemic That Wasn't. This was using the PCR test where they thought there was a pertussis outbreak at Dartmouth. 8 months later, hospital administration came back and said, sorry, those were all false positives. There was no whooping cough outbreak. So, Lindsay, in response to that situation back in 2007 with this exact test and what we see unfolding right now and the concerns, what is your feeling on the use, actually I would say misuse, of this PCR test in the current pandemic?
All right. Thank you, Allison. Lindsay?
So that's a lot. Let me try to translate some of the science speak for lay audiences, if that's okay, Rick.
That's definitely okay.
Yes. So no test is perfect. No medical test of any flavor is perfect. And that includes the tests we're using for COVID. And so what we worry about are false positives versus false negatives. And again, no test is perfect. So we're going to have some of both, and we're going to have more of one depending on the test used. And what do we do about that? Well, we don't only put our decision-making in testing and in case counts. Hospitalizations, deaths, those numbers really cannot be fudged and are not driven by testing. We have seen an explosion in hospitalizations up and down across the country over this past 14 months in different places as the epidemic has waxed and waned. We've also seen a lot of excess deaths, more deaths than normal. So I'm not going to get into a PCR test versus a different kind of test, but let's just all center in the fact that this pandemic is real and it's devastating. But hope is on the way. We have a path out. We are getting there. And now we have almost 100 million people fully vaccinated. So I'm going to put the lane back in the hopeful lane.
All right. Let's take another call. Wade is joining us from Corinth. Hi, Wade.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Rick. Good morning to your guest. And a quick question. It is kind of in your field, but get your opinion. Make me feel a little better. I've completely supported the governor, Department of Health, Department of Ed, with all the decisions, the numbers, the science. But the latest one, as it pertains to returning of school-age children from out-of-state travel, where now continue your normal activities, get a test within 3 days, and then probably wait 3 to 4 days for a negative test, but in the meantime, continue normal activities, including school and workplace. How is that conducive to what we've been doing the last 14 months?
Yeah. Lindsay?
I hear your frustration, and I have a lot of empathy for it. And when it comes to setting policy through a pandemic, there's no easy answer. There's only tough trade-offs. So yeah. We are going to go on, and we are going to have a lot of decisions like this going forward. We kind of have a sticky path ahead where policies are going to loosen up. Some people are going to agree with that. Some people are going to disagree with it. And we all have to stay in conversation with each other and assume the best intentions on the part of policymakers. I know that's hard. But again, we're balancing trade-offs here. There's just no easy path forward.
Now, J&J and AstraZeneca, we've had these adverse reactions, blood clots. How significant have those reactions been?
Thanks for this question, because I think it really is top of mind for everyone.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. The risk of blood clots, which is an extraordinarily rare side effect we've seen, is much lower for these vaccines than, for example, taking birth control pills, and certainly much lower than the risk of getting a blood clot if you catch COVID. These are vanishingly rare instances. That said, my heart goes out to every single one of the women who have had an adverse reaction in their families from the vaccine. So here again, this is all about balancing risks, and it's uncomfortable and it's hard. But again, I think having some benchmarks about risks that we take every day in our lives can help kind of calm the fear a little bit.
Now, I had a caller yesterday who did cite the vaccine reaction, which said that only 1% of vaccine reactions are reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, which is a scary thought. What do you know about that?
I don't know much about that particular statistic, but I will talk about what I do know, which is that many adverse reactions, the way that they're classified, are things like having a fever or having flu-like symptoms. So in terms of truly debilitating adverse effects, we're not seeing them happily, in large numbers with these vaccines. And I think that is really reassuring news, because we are seeing a devastation of adverse effects from COVID infections.
Yeah. You mentioned those flu-like symptoms that some people have been racked by, when they, especially after they get the second dose. So is there anything that people can do to mitigate those effects?
Well, it is okay to take fever-reducing types of pills, but please do so not in anticipation, but after the shot. Also, I think as an employer myself, and as someone who has a supportive employer, giving people a little grace, allowing them to take a day off after that second shot is a kind thing to do. And I also want to end with just letting your audience know that it's okay if you don't have reactions too. It doesn't mean that the shot hasn't worked. People's immune systems have all kinds of different responses to it. So we get a lot of questions at Dear Pandemic saying, I didn't feel anything after my second shot. Am I still protected?
All right. I have Kaya here from the station. Wants to ask a quick question of you, Lindsay. Go right ahead, Kaya.
I'll make it very quick. How do you convince a young adult, 19, 20-ish, that it is best she get the shot?
That's a great question. The Gen X question.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Lead with empathy. Your generation has been through a lot and has had to sacrifice a lot of your youth and socialization. we honor the fact that you're going to get the shot to protect yourself, but also protect your loved ones, your mom, your grandmother. We are so excited for society to get back to normal so you can have a more normal adolescence, and the path to this is vaccination. So really, this is what we call an empathy sandwich. Start with empathy, then provide a fact, then end with empathy.
Thank you.
Lindsay Leininger is a clinical professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School, and she is the nerdy girl in chief at Dear Pandemic. Lindsay, always great having you on. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So feel free to suggest topics or guests. We've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference coming up after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.